This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, a gathering of global leaders on the latest geopolitical events, a better-than-expected inflation report, and another one that says we shoppers, yeah, we're still out shopping. And oh yeah, Tim, right? That crypto problem continuing to unwind thanks to the collapse of FTX. We'll have more on that in a moment.
Yeah, that teeny little company that's just sending shockwaves throughout the industry. Coming up on the program, we get a pulse check on global trade conditions. We do that with former U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez. We'll also look at the state of U.S.-China relations after a meeting between President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping at the G20. And we break down a key corner of the cloud software market with the CEO of Okta.
All of that to come. We begin with the cover story of a Bloomberg Businessweek double issue. The cover is about the crypto saga and collapse of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried that has been unfolding over the past couple of weeks and which continues to evolve and deliver headlines as we speak. Bloomberg News crypto reporter Olga Karif has been following this so closely. She co-wrote the cover. She's here to explain the fallout across the digital asset business and well beyond.
This has been, of course, a huge shock for everybody who's been in the crypto community for a long time, and as well as newer investors who came in the last couple of years. You know, it's a complete shock because Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF as he was known, he was sort of considered to be one of the most sort of trustworthy, if you will, people in crypto. He was testifying in Congress. He was meeting with regulators. He had a lot of respect and a lot of weight in this industry, and all of a sudden his company has come undone.
Yeah, a lot of respect and a lot of influence. Magazine covers, as even he alluded to, he said he became overconfident as a result of that. Olga, one thing that I'm having a really hard time reconciling is the prominent backers of the company and the really sloppy leaked balance sheet that we saw. I mean, how does a company this big have such a lack of understanding of what it has on the balance sheet?
Yeah, you know, it's incredibly surprising. And I think what this means is that there wasn't enough oversight, there wasn't enough due diligence that you need for a company this size with such caliber of investors. Typically, for a company this size, you would have a board and you would have all kinds of, you know, auditing going on and committees and, you know, plenty of people will be looking through what's going on. And what we find is that for FTX, a lot of it has been just, Sam Bankman-Fried overseeing the entire operation.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you note too some of the other tweets that Sam Bankman-Fried has done and talked about how he messed up, different words that he used, and blaming poor internal labeling of accounts. This is not someone who doesn't understand, right, how the sophisticated financial system works. If you look about his past experience, right, this is someone who should have known, or do we give him some room for not having better systems in place? How are we supposed to look at this?
So on the one hand, he is only 30 years old. But on the other hand, during this 30 years, he's managed to do a lot. He was a trader at Jane Street, of course, the very highly respected quantitative trading firm, which gave him Wall Street cred. And then he also ran Alameda since 2017. Alameda Research was his trading firm. Initially, Alameda essentially made money off of price differences on different crypto exchanges and made quite a lot of money that way. And then he branched out into actually running a crypto exchange in 2019. And so he had a lot of experience, I would think, with financial matters.
So what repercussions could he face? He does keep tweeting over and over again that his number one priority is making it right with customers. We'll see if he's able to do that. What consequences could he face?
So in terms of his tweets, they're getting a huge backlash online because people don't trust him anymore, and essentially just almost wish that he didn't even say anything, because instead of this empty promises. In terms of what could happen to him, it's still unclear. You know, FTX is still in the process of filing bankruptcy, all of its requisite sort of initial bankruptcy documents. I'm sure there will be an analysis of what exactly went wrong and who's to blame. Nobody has been charged with anything yet. So I think it's going to be a pretty long and drawn out process. But a lot of people are kind of convinced that somebody, you know, could face charges for this.
Olga, it almost feels like an uber case of FOMO, right? You know, as soon as he got momentum and, you know, media coverage created some of that momentum, you know, you had certain venture capitalists or Silicon Valley investors getting in. And I'm sure friends were talking about, like, hey, what are you guys on to? Like, it's just, you think about how the momentum and velocity that was created by SBF, not giving him a pass, but you realize this can happen, you know, when there are frenetic investments that are out there.
Absolutely. I think we sort of until this year, we were in this raging crypto bull market where, you know, prices were going up like crazy. Everybody, all of the venture capitalists wanted to find the next unicorn in crypto. When they saw, you know, this very respected investors like Sequoia, you know, backing FTX, perhaps some of them haven't done as much due diligence, it sounds like, as they should have, just to check things out. There are sort of standard processes for due diligence in any industry, but I think some of them may have been forgotten in the rush to get in.
That was Bloomberg News crypto reporter Olga Karif on this week's cover story. Be sure to head to Bloomberg.com or the Bloomberg Terminal for more on FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried and the crypto contagion.
It's unbelievable. All right, coming up, renewed hope for a thaw in relations between the world's two superpowers.
What the Biden-Xi meeting in the G20 means for the global economy and for the prospects of avoiding future conflict. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
I absolutely believe there need not be a new Cold War. I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all.
That's President Joe Biden speaking at the G20 Heads of State and Government Summit held this past week in Bali, Indonesia, about the U.S.-China relationship. He and Chinese President Xi Jinping met for about 3 hours, greeting each other with a handshake and conciliatory remarks in which they both called for calming tensions.
The two agreed to a series of goodwill gestures intended to improve ties after the first in-person meeting between the leaders of the U.S. and China since the pandemic began. For more on where the two nations go from here, we turn to Dexter Tiff Roberts, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative and Mansfield Fellow at the University of Montana.
Tiff is also the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism and former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief. We asked him what to make of President Biden's comments.
Keep in mind, this comes after, I think, maybe 7 separate statements by Biden that the U.S. would come to the defense of Taiwan in the case of an invasion by Beijing. And so that, not surprisingly, has gotten Beijing very riled up. So Beijing, I think they would welcome this comment. On the other hand, Beijing has been saying for a while, you say one thing, you, the United States and Biden, say one thing, but you actually act in a different way. And they, along with those other comments by Biden about supporting Taiwan in a military situation, there have been the repeated high-level visits by various, first by back in the Trump administration officials, and now those have continued, of course, most recently with Pelosi's visit to Taiwan.
You've written about China. You know China really well. And we talked about your book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. And I you know, about the divisive system that was there that ultimately would be very challenging to the country's development going forward. How do you see it? I mean, is Chinese capitalism working, or do you see this is a big undoing?
I think they're, unfortunately, you know, they have not made progress on getting the economy to work better nor marketize it more. I mean, really, we've seen the opposite under Xi Jinping for a number of years now, actually, going back earlier, which is this increasing imposition of state control over the economy, continuing crackdown on the private sector. And, you know, today what they're really dealing with is they're sort of, the economy is suffering under the twin weights of both the continuing COVID zero policy, which has, you know, been good at preserving life in China, which is important, but it's been deadly for the economy, and then also the continuing property crackdown. So I would say, you know, they continue to struggle with the economy, and the policy really hasn't been going in the right direction.
How are we as observers, not in China, how are we as investors supposed to kind of read sometimes a move forward, sometimes a step backward?
Well, yeah, I think that's what we keep seeing. And maybe, unfortunately, it's too often one step forward and two steps back. And I think with the COVID zero policy, or the some signs of easing, obviously they're welcomed. People have referred to them as baby steps. And ultimately, the challenge they face there is they announced these slight easings in COVID zero. You know, meanwhile, we've seen COVID surging across the country. Beijing, Zhengzhou, where the world's largest iPhone factory is, and down in Guangzhou. And they simply can't ease up on these policies until, first of all, they have a much broader vaccination program across the country, particularly with elderly people who have a low level of vaccination there. And it's not going to, you know, no matter what they say about easing, they're going to have to pull back until they actually start to get COVID under control.
What do you hear from people on the ground there right now, people you're in touch with, about what life is like and how things have shifted over the last couple of years?
First of all, I think there is a concern, as we were discussing about COVID zero, the rolling lockdowns of cities are continuing. I think there's growing frustration about that, even though there has been support earlier for the government's efforts to try to keep people safe. But we're starting to see that start to see fissures in that, if you will. I think the economy is a real worry about people. Mm-hmm. And there's also a growing concern about this politicization of the economy.
China and the U.S., how would you describe the relationship in the way forward? Is it a good one?
Oh, I think it's actually a troubled relationship, unfortunately. It's really a competitive relationship. They are both see each other very much as their number one rival for global superpower status.
So the Chinese economy, will it still be the engine the world has relied on?
Not great news there. I think that, you know, because of some of the things we discussed earlier, COVID zero policy, the crackdown on the property sector, but then larger structural issues. China's trying to make this transition from a, you know, factory to the world model, which was investment and debt driven, to a much more one driven by its own consumers, one driven by household consumption. And that's a really tough transition that is going to mean probably slowing growth for a number of years to come.
Are we seeing the world divided up? U.S. and its allies, China and its allies at this point?
I mean, I think that it has been divided up. It's we're seeing it slide further in that direction, two separate poles. I would say, though, that the U.S. has made some progress in the last year or two in terms of bringing more allies together. And, you know, China's helped in its own way on that as well. By just one example, its support for Russia relative support for Russia related to the invasion of Ukraine has turned a lot of European countries away from China and made them feel that they have more in common with the U.S.
So given the answers to your rapid fire questions from Carol just now, Tiff, what does it mean for investors? The stocks that traded here in the U.S., the ADRs of Chinese companies, have really been getting beaten up over the last year and a half. What does it mean for investors who want to be in the space?
Well, I'm afraid we're going to see more beating up of stocks. You know, Alibaba, for the first time ever, they just had their massive Singles Day, you know, our Black Friday of retail, online retail sales. And this is the first time Alibaba did not announce what the figures were because they weren't very good, apparently. I think that we're going to see, as I said, a continued slowdown in the Chinese economy. We're going to see pressures on big multinationals. We're already seeing it with companies like Apple to diversify their supply chain out of China. The latest, you know, lockdowns in Zhengzhou on the world's largest iPhone factory just show that. So I think we're going to have to see sort of a re-reckoning with global portfolios and the realization that China won't be the growth driver that it has been.
That was Tiff Roberts of the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative. He's also Mansfield Fellow at the University of Montana, as well as former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief.
More ahead on the G20 and why one former U.S. Commerce Secretary believes little was accomplished.
That's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the last few years have reminded us of how the world as we know it can be turned upside down in a moment. Thanks to the global pandemic, the pushback against globalization, and rising and unexpected geopolitical tensions. We felt that again this past week. This was all the backdrop of G20 as those leaders met in Bali last week.
Here to weigh in on what was done or perhaps what wasn't done is former U.S. Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, who served under President George W. Bush. He's also the co-founder and executive chairman of Empath. It's a human resources consulting firm. And he was not impressed with the progress made on some key global issues at this year's summit.
Very rarely do you get any concrete decisions. One thing that the G20 did do is issue a statement against the war in Ukraine, although it wasn't really unanimous. There were a couple of, there was language that tended to soften the demand, let's say. On the trade side, I found their statement to be very bland, very non-committal. They talk about trade, but they talked about trade in relation to sustainability. So anytime you see the word trade, you usually see sustainability. Nothing about tariffs, nothing about protectionism, really nothing about globalization. So it was a very weak endorsement of trade. I agree that WTO needs reform, and that goes ahead. I wish we had a reformed and strengthened WTO when all the tariffs started. But it seems to me like it's going to continue to be the status quo.
How would you have advised the Biden administration to go into this G20?
Yeah, I would, especially now that the midterms are over, I would have leaned forward a lot more on the importance of trade. Maybe the administration try to get a statement in there about trade and intellectual property and technology, but probably could not get the whole group to go with it. But yes, the administration has really left some big value on the table. For example, the CTPP, a trade agreement which will bring or open up a lot of countries in Asia for U.S. manufacturers, U.S. companies. That was an Obama-era agreement, and nothing has happened. I would have thought that President Trump took it out because he was following protectionist policies, and I would have expected President Biden to come back in because it's for the good of the U.S. It's actually hard to explain because we're giving Asia essentially to China. They have RCEP, which would unify Asia under one agreement, and the U.S. won't be part of it. So I think what's happening is that domestic politics are overshadowing and taking over any foreign policy, but you rarely hear any foreign policy strategy, any doctrine of sorts. It really is behaving on the basis of what works domestically.
Mr. Secretary, it does feel like we've seen a lot of nations looking inward, and maybe that's the result of the pandemic, or they had to take care of their own, even though it was a global pandemic. Do you feel like globalization and global supply chains, that era is over?
Well, there's no question that it's taken a pause, and how long that pause will last is really something to see. But companies who bring manufacturing back, while that's very welcome from a standpoint of jobs, it does raise the cost. At some point, they're going to have to address that. We'll always have lower cost foreign competition. So yes, bringing manufacturing back is a great idea domestically, but it is going to increase the cost. Different supply chains, longer supply chains, or even supply chains closer by that are not as efficient as they were will also impact costs. So I think it's really interesting right now, and this is just anecdotally, but I am seeing more out of stocks than I remember seeing any time during COVID. And that what that tells me is that
what are you seeing those out of stocks in? Where are you seeing that? What are you seeing?
I'm seeing them at pharmacies. And I'm seeing at grocery stores.
Yeah.
Basically, the two places where I go. And it's incredible. It's just hard to find things, and the out of stocks go on for a week or two. And that just means that the new supply chains or whatever supply chains are being constructed aren't working.
Right.
We're not getting the right product to the right place at the right time.
That was former U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez. He's also co-founder and executive chairman of Empath.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, revelations of a toxic workplace for women in the highest echelons of Wall Street's most prestigious firm.
This is not just a Goldman Sachs problem. This is a chronic problem across Wall Street and has been for generations.
Veteran financial journalist Bill Cohen on a hush money cover-up at Goldman Sachs and his new book on the complicated history of another iconic American company, General Electric. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest has written about Goldman Sachs, the fall of Bear Stearns. He's written about the Duke lacrosse scandal. He's written about his friends. His latest subject is General Electric. And it is so great to have with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, Bill Cohen. He's a former Wall Street M&A investment banker, I think, for 17 years?
17.
Long time. Financial journalist. He's been writing for a who's who of business journalism and more, including Business Week. He's author of many books, several New York Times bestsellers, former Bloomberg contributor. And I think you and I even anchored together at one point. We did.
Once upon a time.
Whoa.
The good old days. Wait, talk about glory days.
I'm not even
days.
Needed anymore. I'll just see myself out and listen to this.
His latest book is Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. Really delighted to have you in studio. First of all, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. It's great to be here. Great to be back in this building, honestly.
It is really great. Yeah. Right? A long time ago. You've been busy. Tell us about this book.
Well, there seems to be a strange pattern going on, Carol. Like, you know, when I wrote about Bear Stearns, there was sort of a metaphorical dead body on the ground, and I wanted to know how it got there. Same thing with the Duke Lacrosse scandal. Mm-hmm. Even the Goldman, I wanted to know how it avoided death. And with GE, you know, to me it felt like also there was a dead body on the ground, and I wanted to know how it got there. It was sort of like a mystery that I wanted to solve, and I felt compelled to solve it. So for some reason, I made the crazy decision to go back to 1892, the founding of the company, and try to figure out what happened. And even from the outset, things aren't exactly the way they seem. Hmm. People think that Thomas Edison was the great founder of GE, but in fact, by the time his company merged with another company, another electric company, Thomas Edison was already out of the picture. He was just a small shareholder of a company that was controlled by J.P. Morgan and Henry Villard, with Henry Villard being the CEO. And then it merged with Charles Coffin's electric company to form General Electric. And Charles Coffin became the CEO of the combined company, with Edison not even knowing about the merger, not wanting the merger, and him just like floating off, you know, over to New Jersey to, you know, create some sort of limestone mining company or something. So right from the outset, and then just one more thing, because it is darn interesting, is that was 1892. And then in 1893 was the big financial crisis, and GE almost went bankrupt. And if they didn't buy their debt back at a discount, if this sounds familiar, if they didn't buy their debt back at a discount with permission from J.P. Morgan, they would have gone bankrupt.
So fast forward to today, and yes, what we see with GE today.
Deja vu all over again.
How would you where or when would you describe the turning point into, you know, the quote unquote dead body that you see GE as today? When did that start to die?
Boy, well, that of course is the subject of much debate. It's sort of centered around the idea of whether sort of Jack Welch, bequeathed Jeff Immelt a company that was not nearly as robust as Jack thought it was. Jack thought he had bequeathed him a royal flush, and Jeff thought it was, you know, kind of a losing hand. So whether that's true, or whether Jack actually left, I mean, he did leave him the most valuable company in the world, the most respected company in the world. But, you know, he also, Jeff took over from Jack on September 7th of 2001.
Right.
GE made the engines on the jets. GE had reinsured some of the buildings down at the World Trade Center. And they, of course, owned NBC, which ran with no advertising for, you know, at least a week, costing GE hundreds of millions of dollars. So, and they lost some employees that day. And, of course, everything kind of changed in governance after 9/11. Jeff thought he had gotten a very different set of assets and opportunities than Jack thought he had bequeathed him. But so the question is, you know, did Jeff play the hand poorly, or did, you know, he make wrong decisions? I think really the turning point seemed to be the financial crisis, no surprise, because, you know, GE owned GE Capital, which was, you know, like the third or fourth largest financial institution in the country. And everybody was focused on Wall Street going down the tubes, but GE Capital almost went down the tubes as well.
Phil Cohen's still with us. His latest book, well known, obviously, to our Bloomberg audience and a former Bloomberg contributor. His latest book is called Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. It is about GE. I want to ask you something, though, because you've written about Goldman Sachs. And our most read story on the Bloomberg has to do with Goldman paying out a $12 million or well over $12 million to a partner who complained internally about a toxic workplace for women in the highest echelons of Wall Street's most prestigious firm. This is our most read story all day today. I guess what I wanted to ask you is, what is the right question to be asking? Is this a Goldman story? Is it a Wall Street story? Like, what is it when we see something like this? Which is, as our reporter said, this doesn't happen a lot, and it certainly isn't made public a lot when something like this happens.
This is not just a Goldman Sachs problem. This is a chronic problem across Wall Street and has been for generations. You know, my first book was about Lazard, where I had worked for 6 years, and I had a chapter in there, chapter 14, called It's a White Man's World. And it basically chronicled back then, that book came out in 2007, about the way women were treated at Lazard. And it was not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In my Goldman book, I also wrote about the way women were treated at Goldman. And I think I know some of these women who just, you know, who brought this lawsuit against Goldman. You know, this is a chronic problem across the industry. There's a lot of lip service paid to trying to treat people better, and not just women, but women in particular, and, you know, other people who don't have the opportunities they should have, you know, in
these.
Why
is it chronic?
You know, that goes back to sort of the original culture, the original sins, if you will, of these firms, which were sort of like white male partnerships. And they were family-owned businesses. They were small, little family-owned businesses. There was a Mr. Goldman. There was a Mr. Sachs. There was a J.P. Morgan. There were three Lazard brothers. There were Lehman brothers. So these were all family-owned businesses. They were very wary of outsiders, didn't want, you know, even to marry outside the family because they were afraid of diluting the ownership and the culture that they were creating at these firms. It was a matter of trust. But, of course, as they got bigger and wealthier and more successful, they brought in other partners. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And, you know, and at Lazard, they were wary of bringing in, you know, women. They didn't think women could, you know, do this work or wanted to do this work. And I remember they had one woman, and then the idea was to bring in a second one, and somebody, some fancy partner said, why do we need a second partner? We already have one. It was a second woman. We already have one. I mean, that was the mentality.
Yeah,
yeah, whatever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's ridiculous and needs to change. But it's slow to change. And even when they give lip service to it, it's slow to change because it's not a particularly, you know, pleasant work environment to begin with. It's very laborious, hard work, long hours. Nobody's going to have much sympathy for people who work on Wall Street given how much they get paid. But it's not, you know, a great lifestyle. The work-life balance is completely mm-hmm. messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And hasn't really changed dramatically, you know, despite, again, what they say they're trying to do and pretending to try to do. So, you know, I hate to be a downer on this, but the fact is there's a long, long way to go on this.
Though I want to go back and talk a little bit about the culture at GE, because for years, this was a place that...
Speaking of cultures,
mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, for years, this was a great place to work. Talk a little bit about how the culture there allowed for the downfall of GE.
Or was it?
Well, you know, my first job out of business school in 1987 was working at GE Capital, financing leverage buyouts of all things, which was sort of like the last thing I would have ever expected to be doing in my life at that point. I had been a reporter and had gone to business school and then was working at GE Capital financing LBOs around the corner from here. And then I went and worked for the chief credit officer of GE Capital up in Stamford, Connecticut. I always found GE to be, you know, quote unquote, corporate. You know, I wasn't necessarily a real corporate-y guy, but I felt it felt corporate. You know, there were HR departments before, you know, Wall Street firms had HR departments. You know, there were lots of benefits and perquisites. You know, I got a company car. You know, I got to take these trips and go on golf outings and things like that. And it was sort of like rah-rah and really sort of American and sort of kind of white bready, you know? And, you know, it was okay. You know, I liked the people. I really liked the people I worked with. I think they're a quite unique group of people. And I really enjoyed interviewing the people for this book. You know, everybody from Jack, Jeff Immelt, you know, even to people like David Zaslav and David Calhoun and Dave Cody, the Davids, who all have become very successful. They just loved Jack and they loved working at GE. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, having worked at a bunch of Wall Street firms, you know, and interviewed a bunch of people working at all sorts of Wall Street firms, you rarely get anybody who says how excited and glad they were to be working at Wall Street. But people really liked working at GE for a long time, or at least during this, you know, phase until things sort of unwound.
That's former Bloomberg contributor and veteran financial journalist Bill Cohen. His latest book, it's on General Electric. It's called Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon. It is out now. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, we'll hear from the CEO of logistics software platform Shippo on why she sees recession ahead, and the head of the software maker Okta on the latest innovations when it comes to cloud infrastructure security.
Plus, why Google's Moonshot Lab is literally harvesting innovation right here on Earth. And then we've got a little slice of heaven from our Bloomberg Pursuits team. Stick around. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including Okta CEO Todd McKinnon on everything from the collapse of FTX to the broader outlook in Silicon Valley in a year that has been very, very unkind to tech stocks and the industry. Todd will tell us why his firm, though, is poised for a rebound.
Plus, we take a closer look at Google's famous innovation lab, X, and why its so-called Moonshot Factory is shifting toward more pedestrian projects with actual commercial applications. Our Max Chafkin has a great story in the magazine about a partnership with the fruit farming company Driscoll's and Google's foray into ag tech.
First up this hour, though, we've got a company that's moving things around for its e-commerce customers. We're talking about the shipping platform Shippo, which makes some 100 million shipments annually. We certainly love companies like this. They have a great view of the overall economy, momentum of things being bought and shipped, just moving around, telling us what's going on in terms of economic activity. We caught up with the company's co-founder and CEO, Laura Behrens Wu.
Laura, great to chat with you once again. So you've got tons of thousands of businesses that Shippo serves. You work to use software to get them the best deals on their shipping. Give us an idea. I want to talk about business in a second, but just give us an idea of what you're seeing when it comes to the economy out there, because we're getting mixed reports from some of the biggest retailers out there.
So we're a software platform that connects e-commerce companies to a network of different shipping providers. So all of our customers, they need to ship. They're selling products on the internet, and they need to move their products from A to B to the customers. And we're building that software component there. The carriers are doing the heavy lifting. They're doing the shipping, and we're building the technology, giving access to discounted shipping rates, and just helping SMBs ship like retail giants. And now to your question around what we're seeing, it is a difficult prediction for this holiday season. I think what's for sure happening is that in previous years, we've seen that there was a big spike around the big deal days like Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And we're seeing that change. We're seeing elevated shipping and elevated discounts just way earlier in the season, which is a very interesting trend.
Interesting.
So we don't think that there will be as big of a spike on these two big normal deal days, but those deals are happening much earlier in the season nowadays. And customers or consumers are getting access to discounted products earlier on.
I was going to say, Laura, I mean, I had to pick up something for my daughter and she's like, hey, mom, there's already a Black Friday sale, so you can get it now. So it's definitely happened. Having said that, I do like talking to folks like you because you do have a great indication of what's going on in the macro environment. What you are seeing in terms of activity and the upcoming holidays, does it speak recession to you?
So we're for sure looking at a much softer Q4 compared to previous Q4s, but previous Q4s were out of the ordinary as well, with pandemic limiting us from like going to physical stores. So this year we're seeing a little bit of back to the previous trend lines. And then
so 2019 kind of, or below 2019?
2019 kind of, that is what we're expecting. Also because consumers still have a lot of, like the job market is still going strong. Consumer spending is still doing okay, but it's very hard to predict. I think we're like next year, we're for sure looking at a recession year. And we're thinking that this holiday season will still be a good year for, or good season for retailers.
Remind us too, you talked about the business and we appreciate you reminding our audience about what it is exactly that you guys do, but you do play into the e-commerce sector. I mean, who is your typical customer?
Yeah, our typical customer is an SMB merchant. So SMB is between 500 and 5,000 packages a month. So it's a pretty wide range here. But our typical customer ships anything from fashion to makeup, anything you can buy on the internet. And we've actually seen an explosion in the SMB segment during the pandemic, like more businesses getting started, more businesses moving online. So that's the perfect audience for us. And we're not enterprise. So Amazon and Target and Walmart are out of scope for us. But at like the smaller mid-market, SMB and mid-market segment, that's our customer.
What makes you so confident that we're going to see a recession next year? What's the data that you can point to that indicates that?
Yeah, it looks like all indicators. The tech market is softening. We're seeing rounds of layoffs in the tech industry that will affect other industries later on as well. And I think that is just causing the negative spiral there to consumer spending being worse. And people are, just not willing to spend on discretionary products. Inflation is at a record high, and we've seen the gas prices rising. So all indications lead to a recession year next year. But I'm not an economist, so fingers crossed that I'm wrong.
That was Laura Behrens-Wu. She's the co-founder and CEO of Shippo. She mentioned that her customer base is comprised mainly of SMB merchants, those being small and medium-sized businesses. And it sounds like Laura is really, you know, prepared for a downturn in 2023.
Don't you feel like the tone of conversations, I felt like to some extent, Fed speakers may be starting to think about maybe slowing down in terms of the size of rate increases. But I thought in general, leaders were more and more talking about the momentum's coming down.
Yeah, that's certainly what it seems like. Analysts, too. It's just a question of where the market is compared to where people think the economy is going.
Exactly. All right. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a Silicon Valley executive says he's poised to meet a growing need for businesses everywhere.
Every industry across the world is trying to do more technology, whether that's adopt the innovation in the cloud or keep secure and stop the risk of data breaches or transform digitally and build better customer experiences through the world beating websites and mobile apps. And identity is at the heart of that.
Okta CEO Tom McKinnon joins us on the other side.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
One of the things we love to do regularly is check with CEOs of all different types and sizes of companies for insight, yes, on their businesses, but also on the macro outlook. One such company recently was Okta, which is a roughly $8 billion market cap company. It's an identity and access management software firm working in the cloud.
Guggenheim upgraded the stock to buy earlier this month, saying the firm's valuation is, quote, too compelling to ignore, despite challenges that will take several quarters to sort out. And Carol, you went straight to the source to find out why.
Well, that means we went to the company, right? Bloomberg Radio's Paul Sweeney and I caught up with Okta's co-founder, chairman, CEO, Todd McKinnon. He was joining us from the company's Octane 22 Product Expo event. And as a tech exec who has a front seat on disruption and innovation, we began by asking for his reaction to some big news of that day, and that was the sudden collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's crypto exchange, FTX.
I think we're all watching it, and we're all trying to figure out what it means for the broader ecosystem. But one thing is for sure, Silicon Valley is in a different world than it was a year ago. Everyone is making sure that we're doubling down on our most strategic and important initiatives. And maybe some of the things we were doing last year that maybe wasn't necessary, we're not focusing on that as much as we are all of our core strengths. And that's why we're so excited about this conference and what we can bring to the whole technology market with our world-class identity products.
So, Todd, I'm just looking at the FA function on the Bloomberg Terminal, and it looks like Wall Street analysts have, you know, 30 to 40% growth revenue for the next few years, top line for you guys. What's driving that growth?
Well, every industry across the world is trying to do more technology, whether that's adopt the innovation in the cloud or keep secure and stop the risk of data breaches or transform digitally and build better customer experiences through the world-beating websites and mobile apps. And identity is at the heart of that. You need to log on employees at work and do it securely and make sure there's no phishing or any data breaches. And you need to make sure you give your customers, you're building that great new app at your company, you're getting your subscribers or your customers or your citizens online to connect to you directly. And you have to have a great app, and that starts with a great login experience. And we help our customers and organizations around the world do just that.
You know, I see some of that top line growth, and then I see your stock is down 70-some-odd% year to date. Is this just a tech washout, or what's the street concerned about with your name?
I think there's a couple things. There's definitely valuations across the board in technology are down. And also, we took a pretty big, bold step a couple years ago to branch out into this important new market for us. It's called the customer identity management market, which is we serve with our customer identity cloud. And that acquisition, over the past couple quarters, there have been some execution stumbles in terms of integrating that. And we're working through those now and really excited to talk about our long-term products.
You're talking about that $6.5 billion deal, right, Auth0?
Auth0, yeah.
Auth0, excuse me. So tell me about what kind of, you know, throughput, if you will, that you're seeing already on that acquisition. I know it's early, but tell us about that.
Well, it's a really important strategic part of the market for us because traditionally identity management has been sold as part of a monolithic platform. You got it when you bought Microsoft applications or you got it when you bought applications from IBM. But on the customer identity side, there's this huge untapped potential where engineers and developers and product people, they're building identity themselves. They're spending their valuable time creating login pages and password reset functionality and multi-factor authentication, but there's a better way. Every hour they spend on identity is an hour they're not spending on innovation. So we have this product, Customer Identity Cloud, which is the technology from the Auth0 acquisition that can do it for them and free them up to spend every hour and every calorie they expend on great innovation in their products and not on identity, which we're the experts in.
The macro environment right now and the outlook for your business feels like a lot of enthusiasm, barring the crypto side. Certainly the equity side of things because of that softer inflation print. How do you see the economy and the outlook for your business, let's say, over the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, we've started Okta 14 years ago, and over the past 14 years, we've seen unprecedented growth across cloud computing. Now, cloud computing is the default computing platform for every organization in the world. We've seen security risks and how you could avoid risks with great cyber posture. We've seen that become as important as ever. And we've seen every organization want to connect with their customers online. And the macroeconomic environment is changing. Money a year ago, zero interest rates, investments weren't as focused and as scrutinized as they are now. And so no company, no organization, no industry is immune to that. But what's really giving us a very bright outlook over the long term is these trends continue. Everyone is figuring out how they can adopt the latest technology for their workforce. They want to build world-beating customer apps because in the time of economic uncertainty, many times it's the best time to double down on innovation so you can leap ahead of your competitors. We know this. In 2009, when I started Okta, we took that time, there was an economic problem, but the Great Recession, and we started Okta in this downturn, and it was a good time to focus on innovation, and we built the industry-leading company because of that.
Todd, how would you characterize the risk appetite in Silicon Valley these days? How would it be now versus a year ago?
I think for the top end of the VC market, it's as strong as ever. The overall amount of funding is way down, and you see that happen in these cycles. But great entrepreneurs have great ideas. They might have to work a little harder to raise that round, and the valuation certainly isn't going to be as high. But the best ideas and the best entrepreneurs, they're getting funding. I think that will always be true because there's so much potential in technology. At Okta, we are technology enthusiasts. We believe that over the next 5 years, you're going to see amazing innovation in collaboration technology and the ways to work more effectively and collaborate with teammates remotely, especially on the security side as well. We think there's going to be security breakthroughs that make companies 10 times more productive, which is why one of our core beliefs is that we believe in this world, an open ecosystem of innovation, where the best innovation can be used by any company. That's the right way forward, and that's what we're trying to build.
Hey, Todd, I think people are listening and they're like, okay, wait, what are you talking about? So how does it affect, you know, people in their workspaces and everyday living? Break it down for us.
We've been through the last 3 years with so many people working remotely, and we've been, as an industry and as a collective workforce, we've done a good job collaborating and communicating. But I think the tools that we use, whether it's chat or email or video conferencing, they weren't designed for this world where remote is almost the default, and working in a hybrid way in the office and remotely is the way every organization, every company operates. So I think when we get together in 5 years and we talk, we're going to be amazed at some of the new technologies. Maybe it's virtual reality headsets, or maybe it's a new kind of collaboration software that can mix a hybrid meeting where some people are remote and some people are in the office.
Is this where the metaverse, and I'm not making a joke, like I feel like it creeps into every conversation. Is this where the metaverse maybe has a real world application?
I think about the metaverse as really an evolution of the internet. So mm-hmm. Today we use the internet on phones and computers, but we're going to access the internet on these VR headsets and these augmented reality devices. I think that's inevitable. I think it's a new way to interact with people, and more people over time will use these new devices. But it's the same internet, the same way to work, the same way to collaborate, the same way to socialize as we've seen in the past.
That's Todd McKinnon. He's co-founder, chairman, and CEO of the identity management software developer Okta. Bloomberg Radio's Paul Sweeney taking a part in there as well.
Up next on Bloomberg Business Week, how Google's Moonshot Lab is using its high-tech gadgets to help improve farming right here on Earth.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Think innovation, you probably think about crypto, the metaverse, self-driving cars from the likes of companies such as Google. And yes, some of that goes on at Google's innovation lab that's known as X. So too do a few other closely guarded projects that are literally more down to earth.
It's all in a story you'll find in the technology section of the double issue. It's the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week. The editor of the magazine is Joel Weber. He and Business Week columnist Max Chafkin are here to explain the fruits of the tech giant's ag tech efforts.
So this is an effort by X, which is the quote-unquote moonshot factory of Alphabet, which is the old Google X, to bring, you know, essentially Google's technology to farming. Back in the day, X was really focused on these kind of sci-fi type things like Tim was talking about. You had self-driving cars. They were literally talking about space elevators for a while. And basically, over the last decade,
that has mostly either fallen apart or dialed back. We've seen a couple of these quote-unquote moonshots be spun off, Waymo being the best and probably biggest example, and a bunch of them falling apart. Glass fell on its face. Loon, which was the balloon internet thing, didn't pan out. There was a kite, a wind-powered kite thing that didn't pan out. And a bunch of things that although they panned out, they didn't really turn into the sci-fi thing of the future. And now when you talk to the folks at X, what they say basically is, like, we are moving away from the kind of flashy for flashy's sake and more towards real business that could potentially drive profit for Alphabet, which, again, a Google executive talking about profit is sort of a weird thing if you've been covering this industry for a long time, because, you know, in the old days, the search engine just threw off so much money that they didn't even bother talking about it elsewhere in the company, but they are.
Nice.
And so this is so what's happening at Driscoll's is they built these rovers, they're called. They're smart car sized semi-autonomous tractors that drive over the field, take pictures of plants. What they're doing literally is counting flowers, counting leaves, and attempting to tell the farmers, in this case Driscoll's, which is the largest supplier of the big four berries, and what they're trying to do is tell them which of their plants are succeeding and which aren't. And that's an interesting problem, because although Driscoll's is super sophisticated, you know, they do genetic analysis of in their breeding programs, no one really knows how the genetics correlate to the health of the plant or the harvestability, which is like how high off the ground the berries are. And so they're basically using machine learning to deal with that. And Google, Mineral is the name of the project within Google, has plans to expand this to all sorts of areas. They've got another partnership with Syngenta, which is a major agribusiness, and a bunch of other partnerships. And I think long term, you know, the play is to have some kind of cloud AI service for the ag industry.
First of all, Gregor Mendel would be so happy. But what I'm wondering is, when did ag tech become such a thing for Google, or is it about profitability and maybe another revenue line?
Well, I think it's a couple things. So one is, if you look in the ag space broadly, there is a lot of interesting stuff going on. Even
right.
In autonomy, probably ag is one of the areas where autonomy has arguably, you know, gone the furthest, where you have, you know, self-drive, John Deere and other companies are pursuing self-driving tractors. So clearly there's an opportunity there. And I think really what's happening, number one, is Alphabet is looking for any way that it can kind of broaden its scope. The last thing is, when you talk to the folks at X, and I spoke with Astor Teller, who is his title is Captain of Moonshots. He's the head of the Moonshot Factory. He basically says that they have been really focused on climate as a challenge, as a potential moonshot, and there is a way to see these innovations in agriculture having, you know, a positive impact on climate change.
Right.
Because if you're able to, say, you know, use less fertilizer, that sort of thing, you're going to have a carbon impact.
What does it actually look like in practice? And Mineral is one way that we can
but
talk
about that. Voice is Joel Weber. He's captain of Bloomberg Business Week.
Captain of Moonshots at
Bloomberg Business Week.
It's like a sort of autonomous ATV. It's got rugged wheels, drives over plants very slowly, and there's like a weird little camera studio inside of the machine with flashes and stuff. It takes a picture of the plants and then goes into the cloud, into this kind of AI system that is honestly not that different from the self-driving car system or anything like that. And it says, hey, like, what is this plant? How is it doing? How likely is it to produce fruit? And hopefully in the long run, that allows Driscoll's to say, is this a plant worth breeding, worth continuing with, or is it one that should be, you know, cast aside in favor of other strawberry varieties?
That was Business Week columnist Max Chafkin, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
Props to him for, like, being a straight shooter as we're all, like, kind of, like, coming at him.
Yeah, we tried to derail him many times, and he just wouldn't play.
Max is incredible.
He's a true pro.
He is. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, thinking about your upcoming Thanksgiving holiday feast? Then stop right here.
How to be the host with the most and deliver, quote, a slice of heaven to your guests at the same time.
I'm sticking around for that. How about you?
You want your cake and to eat it too.
I want it delivered too. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We turn now to our friends with Bloomberg Pursuits for a guide to holiday entertaining. And it's tough to be the host with the most if you don't have the menu to match. Luckily, we have the recipe for sweet success.
We've got a list of the very best cakes and cocktails that America has to offer. And you can save those home baking projects for 2023, or if you're like me, Carol, just never do them. And instead, you can just order the cake straight to your table and focus on the drinks. Here with a breakdown are a couple of our favorites. We got Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rauser and our renowned food editor Kate Crater. Kate joining us from her new home in London. Chris, I want to start with you. We got lots of mouthwatering delights in this section. And something really interesting happened during the pandemic when it came to shipping cakes. Suddenly, a lot more people started doing it.
Yes. So a lot of people during the pandemic started baking cakes. They started baking bread. And then a lot of the rest of us looked at those people and said, man, I wish I had some bread and some cake, but I am sure not baking them.
I was one of them.
So was I. And we started having cakes delivered from Gold Belly. And that has continued on even as the pandemic has lightened. And every year we have a holiday entertaining section in Bloomberg Pursuits. It's one of our favorite sections. Kate usually takes charge. And we really wanted to do cakes this year. We felt like everybody needed a slice of cake. So Kate picked out some of the best new and regional cakes to really highlight across the U.S.
I want to know, Kate, how the heck do you always, I'm always amazed because there's so much stuff out there, how you whittle it down.
Well, you know what? It's so much work and research, Carol. It's
a lot of eating.
A lot of work.
Hold on. I can't tell if you're joking here. Like, no. Like, it's so hard to just, you know, try all these cakes and order these cakes. But it is hard, right?
You know, at some point you can kind of hit cake overload, but it takes a lot of research for that to happen. But it's just cakes are so great. Like, they look wonderful. And this is, you know, around this holiday time, it's usually pie season. And a lot of people will talk about pies. But people usually make those pies. And I'm like you. I will eat cakes all day, but I don't really want to make them. And same with pies. Like, so it's great to have a cake because it shows up. Like, I think a pie is just sort of sitting on the table. But a cake stands tall. It towers over everything else. So in the pie versus cake debate, cake will always win.
You're reminding me that it's time for me to do my Twitter pie poll for Thanksgiving. But having said that, so Chris, let's talk about the cake that you featured on the cover, because this looks kind of amazing.
Yeah, this is a strawberry crunch cake. And Kate actually interviewed the bakers in Detroit. So cake.
I knew that was going to happen.
100%.
Cake
Crater. Kate, what were they like?
So the woman who started it, her name is April Anderson, and she's in Detroit. It's a place called Good Cakes and Bakes. And it is something that's really made the city proud. Her grandmother came from the South, from Mississippi. She was part of the Great Migration that came to Detroit. And as we wrote, it sort of is like that kind of like made-for-TV movie story. And April started using some of her family's Southern recipes, but she was also very inspired by the kind of junk food that she ate growing up. So this is a little bit, I don't know if you guys know it, but there were some really kind of awful but also delicious strawberry good humor ice cream pops.
Yes!
And this is a little, if you look at it and think of that, I think you'll see the connection. It's delicious, delicious strawberry cake interspersed with white cake and pink icing, but it's covered with crushed strawberry Oreos that gives it this beautiful neon pink, neon pink color, but also this terrific textural contrast. So it all comes together really, really well.
And zero calories. Man, that's amazing.
Yeah, I didn't see that part in the story, Carol.
I have to say, in looking at the pictures, like, it's a variety of cakes and colors and shapes and styles. But, you know, the coconut layer cake, I'm not a fan of coconut. But, Kate, I always feel like you go into a bakery, you're going to see one. Not all coconut cakes or layer cakes are the same, right?
No, you have to be picky about them because, like you said, a lot of bakeries have them, but some people don't put that much thought into it. And I would say, as a general rule, there are a couple places in New York that have decent ones, but you're really well off mail ordering one from the South. And one of the places that has a really, really good one is called Savannah's Candy Kitchen. It's out of Georgia, obviously, and they make one where the cake is super moist and they pay attention to the buttercream, and it's got, like, so much coconut on it, it looks like the snow fell on it. It's a command cake.
There's also the element of historical cakes here. And I don't know if I'm the only one who had this association when I read that you can actually buy JFK's wedding cake. who had the association with the Seinfeld episode from way back in the day where Elaine eats the cake from, what is it? I think it's like King Edward's wedding or something in Jay Peterman's fridge.
Yes.
And it was
the Wallisons.
So the kind of a throwback for me there, but I had that thought when I was reading this. But Kate, you could actually
It all
go,
goes back to Seinfeld, doesn't it?
It all comes back
it?
To Seinfeld, at least for me.
Yeah.
Speaking of regional differences, though, there's this beautiful cake out of Boston.
Yeah, it's really great. There's this very time-honored family-owned company called Montillo's Baking Company, and they've been there for like 70 years, and they made this cake for JFK and Jackie Kennedy when they got married in the 1950s, and they also served at his inauguration. And this, again, is like a yellow cake, and it's got a fruity filling and just these very like lovely-looking florets of more buttercream on top, and it looks like something you'd want to serve at an event. It's a great cake, and like you said, it has history. But they definitely are there for all the Boston events. When Tom Brady was quarterback for the Patriots, they made a 1,200-pound cake that I think was in the shape of goalposts, but kind of crazy.
And of course he didn't eat it, right? Because doesn't he have that crazy diet? Like he doesn't touch any sugar.
Exactly.
It's like,
truth,
great.
Yeah.
All right, listen.
Took one look at it.
All right, with cake, you got to have some cocktails. And Chris, let's talk about, I love this section that Kate also digs into. And this is about, I'm not a cocktail maker. I don't really bake cakes. But
these only take 60 seconds.
This gives me hope, Chris.
Yeah, so there's a new book out that focuses on 60-second cocktails, which are cocktails that you can make in less than 60 seconds, which really rules out some of the things that our favorite mixologists in Brooklyn are always doing, you know, singeing the orange peel and stuff. None of that. So these are actually really great, amazing drinks to make at home. The authors are Joel Harrison and Neil Ridley. And we loved it. And Kate picked out some of her favorite recipes from him.
Yeah, they're really fun. They take some really, really good shortcuts, good and smart shortcuts. Like they make an old-fashioned, instead of having to like stir a sugar cube around, which obviously isn't too challenging, but it takes time. They add maple syrup, and so that gives it a delicious, earthy holiday flavor. And it's also smart because people generally have a little bit of maple syrup sitting around, you know, in their cabinet on their shelf. And so it's a good way to use up ingredients that you have to make cocktails for yourself, because it's that time of year, because people are invariably stopping by. You can literally grab a couple bottles and mix these drinks in the time it might take you to figure out what wine you're going to pour, you know, that night.
We also in this section have a festive spirits guide, which is, we always kind of do a holiday gift guide for spirits. What do you give people to add to their personal home bar? And we've got some great wines from our wine critic, Ellen McCoy, like the 2014 Iron Horse Stargazing Cuvée Brut, and some spirits too. So would love everyone to check that out.
All price points. There's also some great things on. I'm a big, even like during the week, I love to throw candles. I don't even care if I'm having like a hamburger. I just find it really fun. So you guys have some great choices in terms of getting lit when you're having your dinner party. But I want to end where you've just got a few minutes lit. I'm not talking about the alcohol, but that's that too. But how to be a host with the most, right? We've all been hosts or gone to something. And Chris, what are your thoughts on this section? It was a lot of fun to go through it.
So we went to Daniel Post Senning, who's the grandson of Emily Post. And he's the co-president of the Emily Post Institute. She's obviously the great etiquette maven. And they've redone their book, which came out just last month, actually. And so we called him. He's an amazing resource. We call him all the time.
I bet, yeah.
And we asked him about how to avoid major holiday pitfalls. He had some really good advice. One of the things, people basically go overboard and then they forget that the point of the holidays is like interpersonal interaction and having fun as opposed to gifts and showing. And so one thing he always says, you have to be willing to accept the cost of entertaining. If your tablecloths are too nice, if your glasses can't be broken, don't have people over.
Well, you know, if you're going to get lit at a party, like wine's going to spill on the white carpet. Kate, what do you think about when you either are hosting something or you're going somewhere? What do you think about that side of the equation?
I think the way the Daniel Post setting looks at this is so engaging, and it really sort of makes you think, like, wow, I want to entertain. Like, one of his other tips is that you should, you know, when people come at you with their dietary restrictions, as they invariably do, you should turn it into an opportunity and a challenge and say, like, okay, this gives me an opportunity to do this, or I'll figure out the one dish I can make that speaks to everybody's crazy diets. But you definitely should figure out the best way forward and make sure that you address them, because you really do want everyone to be happy when they sit down at your table.
Do you have a favorite gift to get as a host?
To
well,
receive.
This year now I want to say candles. These candles. Yeah. Like, I want every one of these candles on these shelves.
All right, guys, listen, have a wonderful holiday season, and so glad that you've given us this guide, because it's lots of ideas and thoughts. Of course, our food editor of Bloomberg Pursuits, Kate Crater, and of course, the editor of the Pursuits team and section, Chris Rauser. Happy holidays to you. All right, that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks also to Paul Sweeney, who helped us out this past week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see us on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Time for cakes and cocktails. Be safe. This is Bloomberg. Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.